This episode is brought to you by Merakez, building spaces for life. Merakez is a leading mixed-use developer in Egypt with an ever-growing portfolio of commercial and residential projects. Visit www.merakez.net for more information.
I think that some of the most incredible parts and moments in the films that I make have come from happy accidents or mistakes.
Hello and welcome once again to What I Did Next from A&T Media, a show where we explore life's pivot points. I'm your host, Malak Fouad. On this show, our guests delve into their personal and professional crossroads and discuss how they choose which way to go. These are people who are multilingual, multicultural, with roots in the Middle East. They are engaged, curious, and passionate about knowledge and aiming to leave the world a slightly better place. Today's guest comes from the world of documentary filmmaking, specifically the cinema verite genre. In the studio with me today is multi-award-winning director Jehan Nujeim. Jehan is an extraordinary filmmaker who has captured the zeitgeist time and time again in her work. She's the engine behind such well-known documentaries as Startup.com and Control Room. More recent films include The Square, The Great Hack, which is available on Netflix, and the series The Vow on HBO, all produced in collaboration with her husband, Karim Amir. Jehan is half Egyptian and half American and was educated in both Egypt and the United States. She moves seamlessly between cultures, looking for the next big story. Being at the center of things has always been how she operates, getting inspired by the forces and winds of change around her. This has been her guiding principle, and she has relied on this when choosing her projects. In today's show, we talk about the twists and turns of her career and how she always seems to be at the right place at the right time, capturing pivotal moments and events that have shaped all of our political and social lives. She also shares how things have changed for her now that she's married and a mother to three young children. We open, as always, with one of the show's staple questions, asking our guests about the people or personalities they'd invite to their ideal dinner party.
I couldn't resist having both Jesus and Muhammad there, because I'm sure they'd have a lot to talk about, and there's a lot of interesting, important questions. We could potentially solve a lot of things. Personally, my mentor, D.A. Pennebaker, passed away last year, and I didn't have a chance to say thank you and goodbye, and I would love for him to be there, because not only would I like to have the chance to say that, but he is somebody who is such an incredible conversationalist.
Was he a teacher of yours?
He's a filmmaker. He's made his films with his partner and wife, Chris Hegedus, so she would definitely come along too. And both he and she are people that I made my first film with, Startup.com. And he's just an incredible person. One of these people you meet that even though he's, 85 years old, he still looks at the world with a kind of childlike wonder, and an enthusiasm and a curiosity. And he's like that about people too.
And how did you meet him? Was it through school? Was it through university?
No, I met him because I was, I had been working at MTV, and I was working on a show called Unfiltered, which was basically one of these early MTV shows where we sent out cameras to people and they filmed their story and sent the footage back to us. But after a year and a half of shaky camera, I couldn't handle it anymore and wanted to make my own film.
Yeah.
And so I started making a film about my roommate. At the time, my roommate in New York was starting an internet company. And at the same time, Pennebaker and his wife were looking at VCs that were funding these internet companies and these internet entrepreneurs. And so we met up because we were both making a film about both sides of the situation. And he offered to, he said, listen, we can make two films or we can make it together. It'll be a lot more fun. And
had you seen his work before?
Oh, yeah.
You knew who he was,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, he had made films about Kennedy, Bob Dylan, all of the great musicians in the 60s.
Interesting. So that's three people so
far.
Yeah,
let's see. So who have
else
them.
Did you include?
I never met my grandfather, who lived in, was a family doctor in Port Said, who I would love. He would go around, stories about him, he would just go around on his bike with this little black medical box and just go from family to family and treat them. And I would love to meet him. So I would love for him to be there.
This is your father's father,
my
right?
father's father.
Okay.
So personally, I would have to have my parents there because and my kids, because they would never forgive me if I had Jesus and Muhammad at the table and they weren't invited. And I would love for them to have experienced it as well, because I wouldn't want to just keep, you know, talking about it. I know that's a lot of people. It's an overcrowded dinner
party. It's your dinner. You can have as many as you like.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
You can keep going if you want.
Hatshepsut,
yeah,
is
nice.
A must.
Absolutely.
I mean, she's, you know, is the first. I would want to ask her a few questions.
Absolutely. Do we know that much about her, or is it just a lot of mythology, I think?
We don't know very much. Yeah. There's so many questions. I don't know all the right questions to ask, but my sister studied Egyptology, so I would make sure that she has
she
the
could,
questions.
Yeah.
So that's her. And then,
so it would be a very serious dinner, actually, right?
Yeah, definitely. Maybe
like...
I'd have to get Dave. Well, Penny Baker is not a super serious guy. He would be able to,
yeah.
you know, lighten it up. And
right.
Chris. And I mean, my kids are clowns, so that would add some humor. But I love Dave Chappelle. I would love for Dave Chappelle to show up. And he's, you know, the first time I spoke with him, he was somebody that was planning on doing the Hajj.
Oh, really?
So he hasn't done the Hajj yet, but he converted to Islam. And
huh.
I wanted to do a film with him, which was going to be him ultimately doing the Hajj, but traveling through a bunch of... It was very soon after September 11th, and I wanted him to follow him as he went
very
through a number of different
sure.
Arab countries, Middle Eastern countries, you know, meet the guy who sells vegetables and have a conversation
yeah.
with him. Because he's somebody who, you know, there's so many comedians that... get people to laugh by making fun and cutting down people. But I don't find his humor to be this way. Mm. I think Dave Chappelle really, he's funny without destroying people.
And I think comedians also have the ability to take a subject that is serious and be able to explain it very well to people, because they already have that buy-in from the audience.
Yeah.
You know?
And if he was at a dinner with Muhammad and Jesus, they would, you know, the results of that conversation
yeah.
would
be really interesting.
Very interesting.
Very interesting.
And he would talk about it probably in a very interesting way.
Yeah.
We would need some good music. I know, you know, Nina Simone was, you know, at various points in her life, played a number of different roles. I mean, we'd have to bring Nina Simone along.
For sure.
For some good
She'd
music.
She'd certainly bring a different dynamic to the table.
Yeah.
Interesting. It's an interesting combination of people.
Maybe some Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah, why not?
Then I could invite Aladdin's genie and just ask, and then he'd give me three wishes.
Absolutely.
And we could do it all over
again. We could
do
that. So you could just keep, like, it would be a circle that would just ad infinitum. You'd have this dinner that wouldn't end. The other question I want to ask is, if you could pick one movie, one book, and one piece of music or singer, let's say, that you like, who would you pick?
Film is very difficult because they're
it's hard to pick one,
so,
right?
So hard to pick one. Let's start with music. My father introduced me to some wonderful Arabic musicians, and I'd have to say Fairuz. We would listen to Fairuz together, and he actually introduced me to Suad Mahsi.
She's amazing.
I love
yeah,
her music.
Yeah, I heard her a few years ago.
She sings the song Rawi,
yeah.
like Storyteller,
yeah,
which is
yeah,
a beautiful
yeah.
song.
I saw her on stage at a festival, and Joan Baez was there as well.
Really?
And they really complimented each other. It was really interesting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so these are like folk, Arabic folk music, basically.
Yeah. I loved her. And I could imagine, and Joan Baez is, I mean, I love
yeah,
her.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. What about books? Are you a reader?
Books, yeah. Although, since having kids, I feel like all I read is, you know, How to Raise Your Kid books.
Yeah.
and nobody agrees,
or Dr. Seuss.
I think I've got to stop reading. Yeah, or Dr.
Yeah.
Seuss. I could I green can tell eggs and ham. Green eggs and ham. Yes. We're learning how to read right now. So, you know, we're reading, you know, Pat sat on the cat.
Yep.
You know.
Do you find that your attention span when it comes to reading has diminished with social media and everything being sort of bite size? A lot of my guests have been saying that to me, and I, for myself, I'm noticing that too.
Yeah, I guess I don't know whether to differentiate between whether it's social media or whether it's the kids, because in the last 5 years, I feel like my attention is continually pulled from thing to thing to thing, right? I'm reading Childwise right now, which is a great book about child rearing.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah. In terms of novels, there's so many that I love, but I read a book recently called Americana. Mm-hmm. It's by a Nigerian author.
She's amazing. I read that book.
Yeah. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Yes, that's her.
I love the nuances of it. Yeah. I love the story.
It's really
of
subtle.
Her and how she viewed how she viewed African Americans versus African, you know,
as herself. Yeah, exactly. And it's really interesting how she sees America, because we don't often see America through the eyes of an African. We know a lot about African Americans, but not from someone emigrating from Africa.
Yeah.
And a woman.
Yeah.
So tell me about film. If you could pick one or two movies.
I have so many movies I could recommend. I vote for the Academy Awards, and so we've just been through it. I've just been watching a lot recently. I just saw a great one called The Mole, which is a Chilean film, which has been not nominated yet, but on the shortlist. It's about this PI that's hired to infiltrate this elderly folks' home because the woman thinks that her mother is being abused there.
Oh gosh!
So,
but is it a comedy or is it?
I mean, it's
because you're laughing.
I mean, you're following. It's quite funny. You're following this guy as he's, you know, hired to basically go undercover. And he's an older gentleman, and he's hired to go undercover in this...
In an old people's home.
Home, and just basically try to find her and meet her. And it's filmed beautifully, and it feels like a fiction film, actually. In terms of fiction films... Yeah, so many. They're all like... I'll pick a documentary that really... You know, Don't Look Back... A Penny Baker film changed my life because it was I saw that film and it was following Bob Dylan through his tour of London, and I watched it. It felt like you were there. It was like a time machine. It was the first time I saw film as this ability to this tool to be able to transport people to another place, another time, and give them the experience of actually being there. And it's in the tradition of verite filmmaking, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're a fly on the wall, you're just observing, you're not asking questions, so you're not kind of disrupting the flow of things. And it's literally like you're sitting in the 60s with Dylan as he's strumming on his guitar, or sitting in the back seat with him and Joan Baez as they're making up a song together. And I was just like, I want to do that.
That transitions quite well, actually, to going into how you started in all this. How did you, when you decided you wanted to work in film, how did you decide that the verite genre was what you wanted to do and not just be a blockbuster director, for example? I mean, what was it that you were attracted to?
Well, I started with photography, and I went to, I was going to be a doctor. So, I mean, I think this my whole career and everything that I've done is basically built on failures. Well, failures of the plan A, you know, or failures
so
of what the plan
was. You were
going to
be a doctor. You went to college wanting to be a doctor.
Yeah, I wanted to be a doctor. I took pre-med classes.
This was at Harvard, right?
At Harvard. And I took, I think, it was organic chemistry. And I was just like, there are other people that are going to be better at this job than I am, you know. And meanwhile, I was taking all these photography classes and taking refuge in the VES, the Visual Arts Department. At the time, I felt a little bit like I was cheating because I was coming back to Egypt and taking photographs. And it's like, you know, I mean, what more visual place do you have than this incredible country to take photographs in? You know, it was a little bit like, you know, my fellow students were taking pictures around Boston, and it's
and your backdrop is the pyramid,
right? Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I spent a lot of time. I had volunteered for many years in the Zebelin, you know, working with the Association for the Protection of the Environment,
APE.
And I'd written my thesis. I wrote my thesis ultimately about the organization and about the work that they did there. And so I was doing a lot of photography there at the same time. There was this exhibit that was, I'd been asked to show some of the photographs at this conference of population, the UN Conference on Population and Development. And I was really proud of them. And after like 2 days, they said, you know, I think we should take the picture of the dead donkey out. And then after another couple of days, another one got removed. And people were, you know, some of the organizers had been upset.
What, they considered it negative about
the country? They considered it, why are you showing these photographs rather than showing photographs of the pyramids and the Sphinx and the Nile?
The more classical imagery,
And it was confusing, but it was interesting because it caused all this discussion. And here I was, like, this 19-year-old, you know, who had never had a discussion about anything, you know, of relevance in any kind of public forum before. And it was, you know, we were having these intense discussions about whether these photographs should stay up or down. And it felt like without even opening my mouth, you could take pictures that would make people sort of think and question.
So you were really attracted to the concept of the visual as opposed to audio or written, or so it was that, and it was documentary style.
Yes, right? exactly. So I decided to, of course, when I talked to my father and he said, okay, so you're going to Harvard to become a doctor and now you're going to Harvard to be a photographer.
But your mom saw the interest in that.
My mom saw that I was so passionate about it, and I was spending so much time in the dark room, and I loved the visual medium. And she said, you know, you've got to follow your heart.
And your dad?
My dad felt like I had to follow my heart, but he didn't want it to be just a whim.
Right.
You know,
Fair enough.
He was concerned that's what it was.
But it's good to have that sort of, you know, you've got the good angel on one shoulder and you've got the questioning angel on the other.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's an important thing to have, actually.
It does make you question things. And in the end they said, okay, you do visual arts, but you have to take another serious concentration or major. And so I did social studies, which sounds like a high school class, but it's actually philosophy, economics, and because they were basically like, if you go do photography and film, you have to be able to, or if you become a writer and write as a journalist. What are you going to write about?
Absolutely.
You have to have some kind of context for what you're writing about.
I want to go through the names and dates of your movies for a very particular reason. So 2001, you had Startup.
Yes.
And this came out right when the dot-com crash happened. You obviously had started to work on it a year before or 2 years before when the internet craze was happening. And then in 2004, you had Control Room. And this was about the 2003 campaign in Iraq, right?
Yeah, it was really the media war that was happening.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then you had 2013, you had The Square, mm-hmm. which was, as most people know, I think it was very much the sort of the movie that catapulted you. That, as we know, was about the Arab Spring and particularly the Egyptian awakening or revolution. Then we have 2019, The Great Hack, which was about Facebook, and you were following a couple of people through that, and Cambridge Analytica. The reason I'm mentioning these dates, and obviously the subject of each of these movies, is because it's as if you had somehow you were plugged in to the zeitgeist. And you knew that those were really important milestones in popular culture. So you had the internet revolution. You had the media wars of the second Iraq war. You had the Arab Spring. And then you had the whole Facebook, Cambridge Analytica privacy issue. You were there at each one of these points. And your films came out right at the moment where people were talking about these things. How did that happen? I mean, you can say, great, you did it once, but you've done it like four or five times. And I find that fascinating. And I remember coming to watch, you had done a screening of Control Room in Cairo at one point. And, you know, we were really, all of us were really involved and, watching the media wars going on. And you came out with this movie and it was right about that.
So funny because you sound like my dad. Because when Startup came out, no, but I mean, thank you for saying that. But just that when Startup came out, he said, okay, you know, you did it once, that's a fluke. Okay, now let's find some serious work for you to do.
So, how did that happen? I mean, did you begin working on these things?
No, you have to begin working on these things 2 years before.
Of course. You know? So you're actually before the zeitgeist, you're creating it.
So you want to be, you're looking. You're always looking to be in a situation where you're learning. I mean, that's what attracted me to this whole idea of filmmaking.
But how did you end up focusing on these subjects? Because Startup, we were at that age, I guess, where it was all around us. But Control Room, for example, was not necessarily your world so much.
So Control Room was interesting because I was actually between apartments in New York, and I was staying with one of my college roommates at her parents' house in New York on the Upper West Side. And her parents watch Fox News 24 hours a day. And so I remember I started watching it because I was curious about what Fox was saying. Yeah. And I was at the same time talking with my parents who were in Egypt and hearing about this shock and awe campaign and bombing Iraq into democracy, and people were terrified of what was going to happen to the region when Iraq was completely disrupted. Yeah. And so I thought I have to be in the center of where news is being created, because how is it possible that you have one part of the world in the US and the West that's having one understanding because of the media of a situation, and you know, the Arab world that was mostly listening to Al Jazeera at that time, I mean, it was everywhere at that time, who have a completely different understanding of what's going on. How are people even supposed to communicate with each other, and who are making the editorial decisions? And so it's kind of like you go into these projects with a kind of defiant optimism. Mm-hmm. Like, I have to get access because I have to be able to see how this all works. Yeah. And I'm going to be able to get access. And so I wrote to Nick Fraser at the BBC, who was then the commissioning editor of Storyville. And he was very excited about me doing something and raised the budget really quickly. And then found out that there was another team from the BBC that was there making a film. And so he called me literally the day before I was going to get on the plane. And he said, I'm sorry, it's a no-go. So I said, I this is something I have to do anyway. I called Abdullah Schleifer, who was a professor at
AUC.
And he had sent a number of interns to work
at Al Jazeera
at the time. So Abdullah Schleifer calls the managing director of Al Jazeera at the time and says, listen, I have somebody that I know that wants to be filming inside. And at the time, you know, Al Jazeera, I'm the last person that they want to deal with. I didn't want to deal with a documentary filmmaker.
No, but also I think Al Jazeera at the time was not the controversial network it became later.
Not in the Arab world. In the U.S., it was considered the mouthpiece of Osama bin Laden.
Right.
You know, like because they had shown all of these bin Laden tapes, right? It was as if in the U.S., it was like, if I watch a movie about Al Jazeera, I'm going to see Osama bin Laden wandering around the hallways, you know, getting like, seriously, that's what
getting
people
a cup
felt.
Of coffee.
Yeah, seriously. And so in a way, you're using that sort of negative curiosity about something in order to...
to confound expectations and confound attitudes.
Very well said.
I want to move on just briefly to The Square. Which of these films would you consider to be, for yourself, the film that launched you? Which gave you the power to do things in your own way?
Different ones in different ways, because startup.com really was popular in the States, and was made with these legendary filmmakers, and so in the filmmaking community, it was a known film.
Right.
Control Room was a theatrical release that was bought by Magnolia Pictures, and it did really well in the theaters because it was a time when, you know, we didn't have YouTube yet, so people had never seen these images before. I was awarded a DGA Directors Guild Award for that, as well as I was nominated for that, Control Room and The Square, and won it for that and Control Room or The Square. I don't remember which. But so in the industry, those films really propelled me forward.
I think The Square, you were nominated for an Oscar as well, right?
The Square, I was nominated for an Oscar. Control Room did very well in the theaters. Everybody knew about it. And I think it was partly because we didn't even have YouTube at the time. So it was a film where people were seeing another side to the story for the first time. I mean, people were shocked of the images that they were seeing. You know, it's not like now when you can turn on YouTube and you can see these images in another perspective quite easily if you want.
And you can find the imagery you want now, whereas maybe then you couldn't so much.
Right. And many people felt when they saw Control Room, they compared the U.S. invasion to Vietnam. And so a lot of Americans were really, you know, concerned about it. Access to Control Room. I mean, I basically sat in the guards office of Al Jazeera for 3 days in terms of, and, you know, had this kind of defiant optimism of we're gonna get in, of course, and we're gonna make this film, and you have to have a little bit of I was talking to my mother at dinner. She's, you know, American, so we still eat dinner at 6 p.m you know,
very un-Egyptian. That's lunch in Egypt.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So and I was saying, I'm about to do this thing, and it talks about, you know, do you take the safe decision or not the safe decision? She's like, you've never made a safe decision in your entire life. So, you've always taken the risky decisions.
That's really interesting, because that's the whole point of this podcast, are these jumping off the deep end situations.
Yes. And I think it's that I don't want to ever feel like I didn't do something because I was too scared.
Right.
You know?
Have you always felt like that?
I've always felt that way.
And has that been your kind of way of being across the board for everything? Or is it purely in work?
That's a very good question. I think...
because some people tend to be risk takers in certain things and maybe not in other things.
I think I follow my gut across the board. Okay. And so sometimes that puts you in a situation where you're taking a risky decision, which maybe does not seem as logical as it should. And I've had to change things a lot since having kids, because I think there's that's the biggest factor. That's the biggest change that's happened in my life, is having three incredible kids.
In very short space of time.
And
right?
In a very short space of time. But all of a sudden, it's not, you're no longer really thinking about yourself.
Right.
You know? And you're in this, at our age, we're taking care of kids and we're taking care of parents. And I have a sister who I care about a lot, but from a very young age, I was, you know, she was born with a hearing loss. And so I think that always made me, since, you know, watching people treat her in a mean way as kids, I think that always makes you look out for the underdog.
Is she older than you?
She's older than me. Although, I mean, she would say she doesn't need my protection at all. And
I'm sure.
She's, because of her hearing loss, she's one of these people that reads a book by turning the page. I mean, she just, you know, she can read three books in a day.
Right.
She's one of the smartest people I know. I mean, she's amazing. But it was tough growing up.
Do you feel that before you had children, you were more fearless in your choices for work.
Absolutely.
Do you think that that's changed, or are you still pretty fearless in your choices?
I would say that's changed. I would not make The Square right now. I think there's other people that could make a film like that. You know, my role.
Tell me why.
Because looking back, you know, at the time I was, I felt like it was a very important thing to do. I felt like I was watching something unfold that was a piece of history that needed to be documented and would potentially be sort of whitewashed and wiped away if it wasn't.
And you put yourself at risk in that movie.
And you, yeah. I mean, you're in, it's kind of a lot of, you know, a lot of people
did. A lot
did,
of people did.
Right?
But something good, a lot of things good came out of that movie. You met Karim, your husband, right?
It's funny because I was working with somebody named Cressida, and she was filming. He had set up a stage with his cousin, and there was sort of, there were a number of different stages in the square, and their stage was the stage where anybody could stand up and read poetry or whatever. And so we wanted to film on the stage, and Cressida was filming on it, but she was from England, and so it was at a time when he didn't want to be associated with anybody who was foreign, you know,
really?
because there was all of this stuff on television,
right,
if you remember,
right,
saying that this is infiltrated by spies,
sure,
and all of this.
There was a lot of misinformation going around.
Yeah. So he said, could you please step off the stage? We don't want you filming here. And so she got, you know, annoyed and came back to me, and this guy told me to step off the stage, you know? And then I didn't meet him at that time, but, then Raja Amran got arrested, and her sister, and we both ended up going to the prison to you know, see whether we could help get her out. And
oh, because Karim knew her,
yes,
knew them both,
yes,
as well. Okay,
yes. And then we were someplace in the middle of nowhere in Heliopolis, near Heliopolis,
yeah,
and he offered to drive Cressida and myself back.
Right,
and we
right.
were going through all of these checkpoints,
sure,
past curfew, and it took probably like 2 hours to get back, and we were stopped at every single checkpoint. And I was like, "That's that was a nice thing to do."
Yeah,
you know, and
it was a very unique time.
Yeah,
I mean, people sort of found themselves doing things that they might not have done in other situations.
Yeah,
It was a very, very unique time.
Absolutely. And then we started filming him. I've never actually looked at that footage. We started filming him, and then at a certain point he said, you know, I don't want to be a character in your film, but you definitely need a producer. Can I be the producer? And so...
Had he done movies before? Had he done film before?
He had done some film at NYU. And that's not what he was doing in Egypt at the time.
Was that film for you a major pivot?
It was a pivot in terms of the fact that it really got out there. The Oscar nomination, even though I hate to say that these awards make a difference with anything, because there are so many incredible films that never get any of these awards.
Sure.
And I want to say something about that, actually. Just talking about something that inspired me when I met Penny Baker is, here is this legendary filmmaker, and the first time I meet him, I go into his office, and I had seen the big films that he had done, like Don't Look Back or The War Room about Clinton's election or whatever, and he says, let me show you this amazing little film that I made, and he pulls out this film, and it's called Victoria, and he puts it in, and I'd never seen it before, and I was a bit embarrassed that I'd never seen it before, and I said, I watched it, beautiful film, I've never seen it before, I'm so sorry, and he said, oh no, half of these films nobody's ever seen, but that doesn't mean that you love them any less.
Yeah. But that's really hard as a filmmaker to accept that.
It's very hard to sort of think about, you know, the fact that you're going to work on this film for a long period of time and then nobody ever sees it. But I'll tell you, listening to him say that was absolutely freeing, because if you think about it, 50 years from now, you'd rather have a film that is unsuccessful that you're proud of than a film that's successful that you're not proud of.
But I also think that I understand how that is freeing for you.
That was a very freeing moment, hearing him kind of say that, and then living that way, living by, okay, it's the right thing to do, to follow your gut. And
have you done that with every single production that you've worked on, or have some had to have a slightly more commercial?
It's never worked for me, to be honest. I thought that I was doing that with The Great Hack, and we started to make a film about the Sony hack. We said, this is going to be a film that's going to be quick and easy to do. We'll basically do it in a year. It's a commission by Netflix. We'll film all of the executives at Sony. It's this very interesting coming together of politics and tech and entertainment. And then at the same time, this whole election,
the Cambridge Analytica
thing was happening, and we were like, we can't, we've got to do this. You know? Yeah. And so you can't, I've never been capable of doing that. Probably if I was more efficient, I would have been able to do the Sony hack film and then also do the other one.
But they kind of blended a little bit together, you know?
We still have all of the footage from the Sony hack film. People have said we should go make it.
What about the projects that you wanted to do, or the projects that you followed?
The failures?
Yeah, the failures, or the things that, you know, you followed and you're like, this is it. And then somehow along the line, it didn't happen, but you're like, you're kicking yourself now, or, you know, you felt that there was something there and you wish you had managed to do it.
I filmed Bassem Youssef very early on, and then somebody else ended up coming in and making a film about him.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that there could be two.
You couldn't do two on that. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I think that, you know, that would have been fun. But I'm trying to think of other failures.
Not now. I mean, I wouldn't consider them failures, Jahan.
I've had a lot of failures, so there's plenty to choose from.
I don't think of them as failures. I think of them as, you know, you've followed your gut. You've gone down the path where you're like, okay, this is the story I want to pursue. And somehow it just didn't materialize, or you weren't able to see it through.
Look, I feel like I won the TED Prize in 2006. And if you know what the TED Prize is, they've changed it. But when I won the TED Prize at that time in 2006, they ask you to make a wish for the world. And it's basically make this huge wish for the world.
And you did Pangaea Day.
And I did Pangaea Day. Yeah. Pangaea Day was 1,800 locations in over 100 countries of the world. 4 hours of music and film and speeches meant to and translated into local languages. The center of it was conflict and standing in another person's shoes, and Israel-Palestine became center of the whole thing. That was tough. I mean, that was there was
and
a situation.
You spearheaded that, right?
Yes. Yeah. And it turned into TEDx. So that was that part of it was successful because TEDx has become
came out of that. Sure.
And it's become, you know, one of TED's greatest products. But I felt like it wasn't a success in that. I always wanted it to be much smaller little meetups around the world. I never thought that it should be these gigantic.
You wanted more intimate
events, you know,
more of an intimate feel.
Yeah, yeah. And we had to do, at that time, we were told that we had to do these big events because we couldn't get sponsorship, like Nokia sponsorship or whatever, unless they were these huge events.
Right.
Now I think people would understand more the idea of having like small gatherings
of
men.
But you had to kind of do the big thing in order for people now to do the small thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think
you
so.
You had to pave the way in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the first time I came across an interesting, there was a board member of TED who was Israeli that stood quite strongly against some of the content. And asked them not to ask me to remove part of the content. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I really had to stand up and say, I don't want this prize then if you're going to make me remove some of the content.
And what happened?
And ultimately, TED said, okay, go with it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's impressive.
But it was tough because you just realized how media across the world and in the U.S. works, and that it is these wealthy board members that are able to influence things, and it's in your face.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing this to give a platform for people that don't have a voice, and now you're telling me that I have to remove some of those people?
And what about other forms of censorship in other productions you've worked on? Have you come across that?
I've been very lucky in that, and where I've pivoted to, I would say, I was making very low budget films, and what the Square was able to do was bring on some people, some investors and people that really believed in us and Kerim and my work, to put in money early on in order to maintain an independence. And so when we made the Square, when it got nominated and all of that, we met a ton of incredible people. And I mean, we met I remember walking down the red carpet and we met Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, and they loved the square.
Wow.
And it was, and we met Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt said, Angie, come here. These are the filmmakers behind the square. And Angie was like, yeah, you have to, I want to follow your next project. I want to follow what you're doing. Def, call me.
Amazing.
And she walks
so
away.
So you had another strategy.
Well, and she walks away, and Kareem and I look at each other and we're like, call her? Like,
What is that?
Exactly. Yeah. And we met her about a year and a half later, and she said, hey guys, you guys haven't called.
That's so
and
funny.
We were like, well, we don't really have your number. I don't know how we're supposed to call you.
It's Hollywood speak, right?
Exactly. So her assistant, okay, she said she had her assistant come over, and then we started a conversation with her, and then we ended up making a film with her. We made a film called The Breadwinner, and she came on and produced with us because of that meeting.
Yeah.
So, you know,
but she's taken on interesting independent projects as well along the way.
She really has. Yeah. In our first meeting for The Breadwinner, she came and said, what part of Afghanistan is it? What dialect are you going to? Yeah. I mean, she was really spot
on.
She's
on top of her stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that was, that was
interesting. So, Jahan, tell me, what will you do next?
Well, you asked me about commercial success, and, you know, I started making the Vow mm-hmm. with HBO 2 years ago. We started it independently again, and then again, but we started the Vow independently because we have these incredible funders, people that believe in us, really people who are sort of independently want to make sure that there's these independent films that get out mm-hmm. there and that are made without the influence of big studios.
With integrity and as a whole. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been amazing. They've been our partners on this group of people have been our partners on the last three films, and including The Vow.
Mm-hmm.
And then The Vow ended up becoming a series and was very successful for HBO. It was the fifth, they did the numbers on it, and it was the fifth most watched doc series globally.
And it's a what, a 10-part series?
It's 9 parts.
And you're working on series 2,
and we're
right?
working on part 2. And
amazing.
Part 2 will be probably 6 or 7 parts.
And is that a project that's going to take you, what, the next year, next 2 years?
Yeah, we'll be done by the end of this year.
And do you work on other things simultaneously, or do you take on one thing at a time?
So Kareem is better at that than I am.
Yeah.
Kareem is working on a film about the Lincoln Project right now, and also a film about Boeing. I mean, I experienced it when I worked with Chris and Penny Baker, mm-hmm. and I saw them, how they, you know, lived together, had kids together, made films together, you know,
how is
got
that, though?
Together.
Is it easy, or do you each compartmentalize? You each have a role in your work?
When you're shooting, when you're filming it, it's like you're such a team. And then you get divorced in every edit.
That's hilarious.
Where it's basically like, you know, that's where the conflict comes.
And what is it,
comes.
Screaming matches, or how does it work?
No. Well, I'm a Taurus, he's a Scorpio, so, you know, like, I get the lash of the tail,
and I just go in like the
bull.
Yeah.
No, it's, we're actually good working together. I think it's having kids and balancing all of these things that is the challenge. But at the same time, I can't imagine doing it with somebody who I wasn't working with, because my love affair has always been my work, you know? And now it's my work, my family, and my kids. And so when I decide to go on a trip to film something, it's a real sacrifice leaving mm-hmm. these guys
but
behind.
But I think you've been pretty lucky also, because so far your kids are so young that you've been able to go around as a unit, right?
And it's like, and when you're making decisions together, you know, and you're making decisions about, and we both know it's very difficult to quantify how useful a shoot will be, right? But when you're working with somebody, there's an unspoken language, and you understand how important or not important it is.
I want to thank Jahan for being so generous with her time for this chat, and thank you all for joining me on this episode of What I Did Next. The show is brought to you by A&T Media with me, Malak Fouad, and is co-produced by Chirag Desai. I love hearing from you, so please connect with us on Instagram by searching for What I Did Next. I really hope you can join us again in 2 weeks' time.